Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Indie Football Podcast. Once again, rising above the noise after a busy weekend in the Premier League and, probably more importantly, the Carabao Cup, the final of which we saw on Sunday and at which two of the men alongside me were present. So without further ado, may I introduce Miguel Delaney, Chief Football Writer of The Independent. Hello, Miguel.
Hello.
How are you?
Good, good, yeah.
Excellent. Thank you for coming in today. Just 27 minutes late.
What? No, Jack, like 17.
Jack, who was earlier than Miguel. Jack Pitbrook, barely. Welcome.
Barely. I would have resigned if I'd been later than Miguel.
No, you would have been forced to resign, which is slightly different, but yeah, otherwise similar. I think we should probably start with, I mean, it was the big game in terms of trophies, in terms of importance and stuff. Man United, Chelsea, though, it felt like had more build-up this weekend. Mm. But I will leave it out to you guys. Which one do you want to go with first?
There was more narrative value to, there's more storylines to Chelsea United given everything that had happened, and I suppose given the situations of the two clubs in which I suppose both had relatively underwhelming times lately. Although Chelsea had kind of rallied before the game with the draw against Barca.
We remember a month ago when that row really flared up with the Sementa de Nile, the little man, the clown, all these comments went on between the little war of words. And I can't remember which one it was. It might have been Conte that said, I'll see him out there, like February 26th, you know, we'll be out there. That's the thing. It didn't have that feel.
No.
It had completely lost that momentum.
There was just enough distance, and I suppose too much had happened in the meantime. Although very magnanimous of Mourinho to declare it over once he'd won the game.
Yes, yeah,
like,
no.
Yeah, it was like, as ever with Mourinho, my there's nothing better than when Mourinho thinks he's being sincere.
Yes, yes.
When Mourinho thinks he's being humble or modest. Because obviously he's the least sincere, humble or modest person in the world. and so when he tries to make these big gestures, they just fall. I mean, they look ludicrous.
A veneer of sincerity that comes after, Miguel, what you'd have to say, probably one of his better wins as Man United boss.
Well, I'd heard this morning that he personally feels it's one of the most satisfying wins at United, not just because he's beating someone he had that spat with, because in terms of how the players followed his instructions, they came from behind. And I think connected to that, this was notable, especially in the second half. It wasn't a game which they kind of played for more conservatively for a draw. Even though they were much more proactive than against Spurs, say, when they also won. And I think some of that was because this was a game maybe he knew that he couldn't play for it, or couldn't be seen to play for a draw.
Do you think there's a basis in that second half performance for, you know, the United to improve over the rest of this season and into next one?
Maybe actually. What was maybe good for everyone as well, that Pogba played, didn't do anything too flashy or spectacular, but put in a very disciplined performance, and as if kind of it was as if both he and Mourinho had come to kind of an agreement in that sense. And I think that was key, given a lot of the debate of the last week.
What we will do actually is we'll dial up Mark Critchley, who is at Old Trafford, get his thoughts on the game in a little bit. I was watching this is a slight diversion. I was watching the game with someone who's not particularly well versed in football, and I was explaining kind of Chelsea in the Abramovich era.
Yeah.
They actually have probably been one of the most interesting clubs in England over that period. They have had so many, they've been at the centre of so many stories. I was explaining, you know, the Mourinho departure that you wrote about last week in 2007, the Mourinho meltdown in 2015, but then all the other things they've had in between. You've had like an interim manager, Roberto Di Matteo winning the Champions League, an utterly ludicrous thing to happen. They've won the Europa as well.
Yeah. You know, they've had a race storm.
They've
had one of their players shooting an apprentice with an air rifle or something like that.
Yeah, no, it's
they had AVB.
I mean,
as
Luis Felipe Scolari, two tries of goose hiddink, Avram Grant reaching the Champions League final.
That's what I mean. Like, they Chelsea have been, for the last 10, 15 years, arguably the most interesting club in England.
It's been the most like a soap opera, hasn't it?
At the very start, given all of this, even when you consider how it started as well, when Abramovich first came, that summer of 2003, I remember, like, he was kind of... It was like someone had just pressed cheat on Championship Manager or something like that. Well, hang on, have they signed on how many players? And they're getting
Damien Duff for 17 mil.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But do you not think, like... my rough point that I was making, kind of when I was thinking out loud during that, was... The only other club that's been consistently interesting throughout, because I think Chelsea basically haven't gone through a period where they weren't interesting in that time,
are
Manchester United, because they had Fergie all the way till Moyes.
Which meant they were always competing.
Yeah, so that was always interesting. The Moyes era was interesting for a completely different reason, because it was just a complete dumpster fire.
Yeah.
Then you had Van Gaal, which was probably the dullest point they went through.
But Van Gaal himself made it quite interesting.
Exactly. Yeah. The point was, the football was terrible, but... The goings on and like kind of the politics around the club were very interesting. And then now Jose Mourinho can't fail to be box office. You know, the best thing that could happen in terms of them being interesting next is he has another meltdown and gets fired. But we'll see if it plays out the same way as it did at Chelsea. I just think these two clubs that we saw, the reason this game was built up is because these have been the two most interesting clubs in the Premier League for probably 15 years now. You know, Manchester City have won leagues. Arsenal have done bits and bobs, trophies here and there. Liverpool have been there and thereabouts. Spurs have become interesting, but virtually solely because of Mauricio Pochettino. You know, but before, like, the Sherwood stuff was a bit of a joke, and Harry Redknapp, whatever. So it just struck me that this game is two of the most kind of storied sides around. And it did lose the heat that we had in January. The spit between the two game the two managers, and they were saying things that you don't usually say about other managers. And do you think that there was a deliberate attempt to take the heat out of this, because it was only going to end badly for both of them if they came into this really kind of spitting flames?
I imagine that both managers realized how unedifying it was what happened in January, and realized they kind of had nothing to gain. Like, you don't have anything to gain by ramping up. The only thing, the only way you win that argument is by winning the game.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like
by
saying, if you know, there are other places that they could have gone. They could have referred to other incident bad things that each manager's done in his career in their press conferences on Friday. But if you do that and then don't win, you look even worse.
Yeah.
They both have skeletons, don't they?
Yeah, they both tried to do the same thing, which is say nothing and win. But ultimately, it was Mourinho, not Conte, that managed to.
And
do
I think
that.
Even in the build-up to the game, I feel like if it's a month gone, it kind of, you know, with every week or every day, the impact of the words lessens in terms of how it can be thrown back on you. But if it's reignited like 2 days before the match, their press conferences, then if you lose, everything you can say can be thrown right back in your face.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, I mean, you can kind of, as frustrating as it was to be at Conte's press conference on Friday when you got no interest in that. And there wasn't an element of hypocrisy to it. I mean, Matt Barlow of the Mail asked Conte, like, how is it okay to talk about this a month ago but not now? Which is an entirely reasonable question. But at the same time, there's also a reasonable response.
Before we talk about the game itself, which we should do, I guess, let's dial up Critch in the North, our Northern football correspondent, who is at Old Trafford with Johnny Lou. Johnny's on holiday this week, so we'll just get the Critch version. And he should be, give me just a second, he should be on the phone now. Hello, Critch, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Highs of a temperate 3 degrees Celsius in Manchester today, so I'm all well.
Good to hear, mate. Good to hear. I guess going into the game, Pogba was the big talking point. What do you think of his day overall?
Yeah, well, the funny thing about Pogba right now is that just after he's been punished and demoted by Mourinho, injuries have meant that not only does Mourinho have to play him, but he has to play him on the left-hand side of a midfield three, which is what a lot of supporters and journalists have been asking for, to the extent that it became a bit of a meme recently. But the same thing happened in Seville as well, and he didn't play that great there. Now, yesterday was better. He made a slow start like every other United player, and you wouldn't say that he imposed himself on the game at any point, like he did at Everton on New Year's Day, for example. But I think after that sudden dip that he had in recent weeks, you wanted to see gradual progress yesterday, and he provided that. And now it feels like if Herrera is out for a few weeks, if Mourinho has few other options to turn to, then the sting has been taken out of this Pogba situation, for now at least.
And you've written something this morning on Romelu Lukaku, who finally came up big in a game that mattered. Thanks for sniffing through the phone call, Miguel. Tell us a little bit about Lukaku and his performance.
Yeah, the piece I wrote basically talks about how Lukaku looked re-energised yesterday, because I don't think we can judge his first year at United without taking into account that this is a guy who was featured in all but two of United's games, playing almost every minute without any adequate backup. That was fine at the beginning of the campaign, and it just so happened that United were given a kind start by the fixture computer, but the signs of fatigue were there during the winter, and that's when United came up against the rest of the big six. Now, Lukaku wasn't even scoring against the likes of Huddersfield and Brighton at that point, so you couldn't even call him a flat-track bully. He just looked shattered. But as the schedule has eased slightly into the new year, his form's picked up too. And yesterday he was lively, he was busy. He basically made the goal happen and then created the second. Now, it's about whether there's more to come against the top six. His record against them for Everton was 15-58, which is by no means fantastic, but not disgraceful either, considering he's often on the weaker side. And at United, the big caveat to all this is Mourinho's big game approach and how that affects Lukaku's play. But I think yesterday you saw that he is capable of doing it.
Okay, and after all of it, what do you think the actual outlook is for United now? Like, you know, is this the top four sealed for them?
I wouldn't say top four is sealed. I still think that the problem with this team all year has been that it has rode its luck a little. It's ran a little hot. De Gea, who was pretty poor yesterday, in fact, well, most of the time he's actually had to bail them out on too many occasions. And you saw that the luck started to turn recently at St James's Park. Now, you know, don't get me wrong, the spread's 6 points. United should close it out from here. But if you were going to rank the four of those teams in terms of quality, I think I personally would rate Liverpool and Tottenham slightly higher at the moment. On paper, they certainly have the simpler run-ins. It may well come down to United and Chelsea, and in that case, I'd just about back them to get over the line, but I don't think it's by any means a certain thing yesterday, no.
And also, just before you go, mate, I'm just interested, because you don't get to see Chelsea much, I guess, being up north, what do you think of them tonight? What do you think of them after a big game where they've kind of taken the lead, fallen behind, and what do you think Conte's prospects are?
Chelsea, weird. Very strange performance to peter out like that, having started so well, to lose to a team that they initially looked much, much better than. I think the biggest challenge Conte faces now is building and sustaining momentum, because second half there was just an air of resignation around them yesterday. Now, I suppose that's hard to avoid when everyone's convinced that your manager's going to resign, but that second half was the first time I've watched them this season where Conte properly felt like a stopgap before the next one comes along. I rate him highly. I don't think it's beyond the realms of possibility that he conjures up something special at the Nou Camp, or perhaps they win the FA Cup. But that performance began to feel a little deathly, as though something was approaching its natural end. And it's something he needs to arrest if Chelsea want to be in the Champions League again next year.
And I guess that's a point, Jack, is that Chelsea do need to be in the Champions League. That is, for Roman Abramovich, an absolute, you know, I don't know, it's a key pillar of the club, right?
Yeah, massively. I think it would be such a... it's funny, like Arsenal and Manchester United have had their times out of the Champions League and Liverpool, but for some reason Chelsea feel like more of a... With the exception of that, the Mourinho season, as we call it, they've always otherwise been there. And the whole Chelsea managerial model, as in getting in a new guy every 2 or 3 years for a relaunch, is done really to maintain those high standards and not to let the club drift. So if they do fall into the Champions League, especially having won the title last season, it would obviously be a big blow to the self-esteem of the club.
Be curious,
and a kind of mark against Conte as well, I think.
If Conte comes in after, he came in after Euro 2016, right? Wins the league first season, potentially fifth in his second season, and then leaves. How do you think his time at Chelsea would be judged?
That's a good question. I think... obviously well, because winning the Premier League is hard. Lots of very good managers have tried to do it. You know, Klopp hasn't done it yet. Pochettino hasn't done it yet.
Guardiola hasn't done it
Also
yet.
Given the situation he took over from. Yeah, like, to be honest, I think ultimately he's come to England, he's proved himself, he's won it. That'll stand to him regard. And he can always point to the complications of Chelsea.
Right,
as well.
Let's say they come sixth and he leaves at the end of the season, whatever. Like, last season will always massively outweigh this season. Like, there's no sense that the two balance each other. Yeah. Winning the league is much better than coming sixth is bad. So, you know, he will then go on to, I don't know, Real Madrid or back to the Italy national team or a big job in Serie A. And he'll continue to do really well. Like, this is a guy that's won 3 Serie A's and 1 Premier League. I think an interesting question, apart from what it means for Conte, is what does it mean for Chelsea? Like, what can they, once Conte goes, what do they do next? I think that the Conte cycle shows that this is probably kind of the ceiling for Chelsea. Mm. Like, they're never going to be able to, I don't think they are going to be able to compete with the very richest teams in Europe when it comes to signing the very best players. And equally, they're not going to, I don't think that they're going to get a manager who can build over a 5-year cycle. Like, they're all, it's going to, this is as good as it gets, basically.
Yeah.
Get a good manager, push for the league, manager gets a bit bored, get a new guy in. And this is kind of, this is as good as it gets for them now.
I was talking to someone close to, who knows Roman Abramovich quite well the other day, from the football side. And he was saying that Abramovich actually, as much as Chelsea have been reined in, a lot of that has been to do with advice from people close to Roman at Chelsea rather than his decision. And there's still a belief that depending on his mood, depending on how one season goes, next summer probably or the following summer, he could just make the decision, okay, let's go big again. They think the money is there and they can still comply with FFP. And also, there's the kind of logic being pointed out that what Chelsea say spent whatever amount on three kind of 7 out of 10 squad players to a certain degree in January, whereas why not just throw all that money towards one big star, and the multiplication effect in the team is probably bigger. Given how important Hazard is, say.
So, out of 10, what each would you give it? Conte's not there first day of next season. How likely?
8.
8, you reckon?
Yeah, 8 or 9. I'd be so surprised if he's there next season.
So we're assuming Conte's not going to be there. How likely is it that they can find someone of the same level or better than Conte this summer?
No,
because I feel it's very unlikely.
I mean, there is. How, I mean,
do you
how
think Luis Enrique is of that level?
No.
Like, how many managers are there who's good as Conte? Like, no one.
And we have the problem with Luis Enrique actually that because of what was at Barca, we don't really know how good he is.
Leonardo Jardim from Monaco.
Yeah.
Upgrade or equivalent, or is it a downgrade?
Downgrade.
A downgrade.
Sarri would be a good appointment, but I still don't think he's as good as Conte.
His English supposedly better now than it was, which suggests he might be keen in a move to England. However,
I know for certain that Sarri's been keen on a move to England for a long time, watched an awful lot of Premier League, and used to tell the players at Napoli that he really wanted to manage Tottenham. He wanted to replace Pochettino, if ever Pochettino were to leave. So it's something that Sarri's had an eye on for a while.
And then, you've got a new manager coming in. That's maybe the time when you give... I guess the managers don't actually have that much input to the player signings, the recruitment, as we found with Conte and Mourinho, but that might be the time to buy a big player. But when was the last big, splashy signing Chelsea made?
I mean, even Morata doesn't really feel like that.
N'Golo Kante was like player of the year, but he didn't even feel like a big splashy signing.
And they got him because of a clause as well. Yeah, it was inevitable he was going to go. Jesus, you'd have to
It should be Morata, really.
It should be Morata. Yeah, and actually, you know what? We should mention Morata because coming out of that game where Lukaku really stood up in a big game, as Critch said, we had Alvaro Morata again. And the problem with him is he needs just the proverbial backside goal, whatever. He scored a wonderful, it was a beautiful finish, which was obviously flagged for offside. What do you think about his struggles? You know, it does feel as if Chelsea are going to have to go in for a striker this summer.
Well, Lewandowski having gone to a new agent.
Yeah, well, and an agent that's close to Real Madrid and Chelsea.
Yeah.
You know, that's one that I think is interesting. But do Chelsea go out and buy a 29, 30-year-old Lewandowski?
Like, this could be the sort of deal we're talking about in that sense, that they just wake up and...
I agree. It's just
it's funny that, because it would completely kill both Giroud and Morata if they were to go and get Lewandowski.
But, and also the whole point has been that they're buying younger guys, wasn't it? They're buying younger players who they would turn into stuff. I'm slightly concerned about their Courtois, Hazard
contract situation. Especially they don't get Champions League this season.
Well, yeah. Now the power is hugely with the camp of both players because they're going to be like, well, let's wait and see if you get top four. Because if they don't get top four, then you've got Courtois with a season left on his contract and no new deal in place, no Champions League football. It's going to be difficult to get that deal done with Real Madrid looming.
Yeah.
And Hazard. Expire next summer?
From what I've been told, United, there's no fears of United right now about De Gea and Real.
De Gea.
What? Because they think that Courtois will go to Real?
Just it's not saying that they think De Gea is happier.
Okay.
That he's it's not saying pressure that has been saying summer 2015 or 2016.
Yeah, our understanding was that Real Madrid have told United that that's a player they'd like to be kept abreast of their situation, but it's not. I think it's imminent. I think Courtois just looks a lot more likely because, you know, he's positioning himself very strongly as well for that move. You know, he's got all the leverage. I think we're going to see it more in American sports. It's already happened where the big players who know their value, elite talent, they can really push the envelope on these contract situations, because if you just let it tick down like Mesut Ozil did, suddenly the leverage is huge and you can make massive amounts of cash.
How hard do you think City will come in for Hazard this summer?
Someone who knows Hazard very well has been saying that Guardiola actually thinks
that would be
interesting.
I couldn't see it happening.
Abramovich has never ever been strong-armed for a player that he wanted to keep hold
not
of.
Once, by any club.
But that's actually an interesting point in terms of contracts, because if you look at a club that, now, they're very good at negotiating, but they are kind of almost the most susceptible to being strong and armed because of recent history and all that, but Tottenham, and they've probably been smarter with contracts than everyone else, because they get in very early, even when there's time left. If a player's performing well, even when there's time left in the deal, they offer them that upgrade. Knowing players in most cases will accept the immediate wage rise.
Always.
But and it just kind of prolongs their...
Notable exception, the guy you've written about today.
Toby Alderweireld.
Yeah, well, interestingly on that, I know that someone close to the Spurs dressing room told me recently that all the Spurs players say that Toby is the only one who's got the club by the balls, in the sense that with all the other players, the club is really in the position of power and they're offering these kind of small wage rises every year, which generally the players always sign up to. Whereas because Toby's got this £25 million clause, which kicks in the summer of 2019 if he hasn't yet received a new deal, and because he is legitimately asking for basically three times his current salary because he's so outperforming what he's currently paid, he's in a position where he's got no reason to sign anything Tottenham put in front of him. And if he doesn't sign anything, then Tottenham basically have to sell him this summer, because they know that, you know, you'd rather sell him for $50 million in the summer of 2018 than for $25 million in the summer of 2019.
Absolutely. And presumably no confidence that in that year gap you could get a deal done, because he doesn't need to take it.
Right. Why would he accept a small pay rise when City, Manchester United, Real Madrid, Chelsea, whoever could offer him three times what Tottenham currently pay him? Is that what you think, Miguel?
Yes.
Broadly, yeah. Going back to Man United Chelsea, just before we do move on to the game that you were at, anything from the actual game on the actual green pitch inside the white lines that stood out to you? I'd say Scott McTominay looked quite
very
tidy.
Impressed with him. The love only grows, apparently.
I love it when he grows.
No, the love only grows.
Oh, the love only grows. Okay. Yeah, no, I thought...
Love grows where my McTominay goes.
I thought he was decent. I thought... Their defending for the goal was very un-Mourinho. They were all over the place. The back four was a shambles. Well, McTominay actually lost. McTominay loses his runner. Valencia is keeping everyone onside. They really were at sixes and sevens. The entire defensive line was all kind of working on different principles, I think. Very nice goal. Incredibly brisk counter-attack. And Willian, who was getting criticised, 3 weeks ago? 4 weeks ago by Chelsea fans? Has suddenly come up big.
Yeah, he was really, really good in the one all against Barcelona last week. What really impressed me about Willian, amongst other things, is how quite a lot of the time you'll feel like he's not really Chelsea's first choice at the start of the season. Like the start of this season, for example, they were playing that 3-5-2 with Hazard and Morata, and yet Willian always forces his way back into Chelsea's best team. There's not really that many players like him in the Prem who are that technically good, that fast, that consistent, defensive work rate. He's kind of a complete modern winger, really.
Mm. The depth that Brazil have in that position going into the World Cup is frightening.
And I also think, I mean, we will touch on this later, but I think Willian is the kind of player who can cause City serious problems on Sunday, because obviously Fernandinho is injured, and Fernandinho's City's only defensive midfielder, really. And given the damage that Willian can do in counter-attacking those positions, if City are going to play Gundogan there, who is a good player but can't defend, then they could be in trouble.
That's one thing I thought United were actually very good at in the second half yesterday. Because the first half, there have been a few occasions when Chelsea spanned their centre-halves to create openings, whereas in the second half, United stayed attacking but weren't as vulnerable to counter-attacks.
And United turned it round with one goal by Lukaku, which was wonderfully played.
It did seem very much a proving a point performance from Lukaku.
Well, he was just his all-round play was superb. The cross for the second was exquisite, right? On his wrong foot as well. Which I think it's obvious he needed this big game. We spoke about it with Critch earlier on the phone. But they are now, like, if they've got if they've got Lukaku firing, and you've got the potential for Sanchez, the potential for Martial, the potential for even like Lingard to come off the bench and do something, it does make United a more dangerous team. And I think it was Johnny that said to us yesterday that it was kind of the perfect Mourinho United goal, because it was just all the expensive players kind of coming up with something at the right moment, which is exactly how he sets up the team, right?
Pretty much, yeah. Now, whether it's a long-term strategy is another issue, because it's not exactly much of a strategy.
All you need is the elite players to keep performing at an elite level, but, you know, which is, as Real Madrid showing you, perhaps more difficult than you think. Man United, Chelsea, anything else you want to add before we move on to the game of the weekend?
No, I think I was just impressed with United's resolve.
Yeah. No, I mean, I really didn't know going into the game what to expect in terms of result or like intensity.
It was a lot more open than I expected. Yeah. I thought it would be a much cagier game. But I think that comes down maybe to... Actually, that might be one way that all this public spat, which we so hate, et cetera, actually had a positive effect on the game.
In the sense that both managers needed to win.
Both managers would more want to... Yeah, maybe overrode some of their instinct for such games.
You needed a statement win, even if it wasn't a statement performance, didn't you? Because fundamentally, if it was 1-1, which it looked like for a time, you weren't sure how much it helped anyone. Now, Chelsea are 2 points off Tottenham. They're 4 points off Liverpool. They're 6 points off Man United. I mean, it's going to be difficult for Chelsea to get in there. It really is probably going to end in tears for them.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But anyway, let's go to the top of the table where Manchester City, champions-elect, are already looking at a double and possibly a treble, Jack. What were your thoughts on... I say dominant.
So dominant in the second half. I thought City were actually really poor in the first half.
Yeah.
It was funny because they did something which they did quite a lot last season, which is playing De Bruyne, David Silva, Fernandinho and Gundogan in the same midfield, which is something that Pep is kind of addicted to because he loves midfielders. But kind of counterintuitively, playing four midfielders made City worse in midfield. I thought they were really, really poor. They didn't keep the ball well. They didn't pass it well. Like, the goal came from a goal kick kind of out of the blue. And Miguel and I were discussing this. Like, a better team, in Tottenham, Liverpool, maybe Chelsea, on their day could have beaten City yesterday. City were very beatable. But, of course, Arsenal couldn't do that. And then the second half, City turned it on and took the game away from them.
That should be one of the most frustrating things for Arsenal. But also, they did seem to start the game with a workable game plan that you know could have caused City more problems. I mean, because I think they did quite well when they played City last time at the Etihad. They didn't lose the game, but that was a City on better form, and now a City on worse form, they might have had more joy against. But then, typical. First of all, they concede a goal they never should have conceded. That, as Wenger himself admitted, was self-inflicted. Whatever about all this nonsense about whether Reguero fouled Mustafi, which I don't agree with. And secondly, not just that they self-inflicted, but then it was the effect of that goal on them. Because it was if after that they were still trying to execute the same game plan, but it was just all conviction had gone out of the team. Like, after that, it was kind of, this is done.
Yeah, it was really poor howl. There was no second-half response from Arsenal at all.
Mm.
Well, they gave up. You guys didn't hear it, but everyone else who's listening probably watched this on Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And the last 20 minutes of the game was essentially a Gary Neville diatribe against Arsenal, to the point that it felt almost prepared. You know, that he feels almost personally let down and offended by the lack of effort from the Arsenal team in the second half.
The weird thing I've said about Neville in these situations, and not to create, he's a brilliant pundit, but he always goes for the players over the manager. Like, did he directly criticise Wenger
yesterday? He went for everyone.
Did he directly criticise Wenger yesterday? Because he's always been averse to doing that. And I think it's just because of the culture he grew up with, and yeah, basically having Fergie as the kind of this patriarch of the club. And
completely beyond reproach.
Yeah.
Right, and therefore instilling this idea that all problems come down to players because you can't possibly blame the top manager. Yeah.
But also, he has been both. And I think that as a player, like he, you know, he said this extensively, kind of, he went out there and did the job that he was told to do.
Yeah.
And they won games because of it. Now, if he'd played in a worse team, perhaps he might not have the same view.
Yeah.
But he went out and he did his job that he was told and they won games. Whereas he was manager at a club where players didn't follow instructions necessarily, and they lost a load of games, and perhaps that's maybe even more so cemented his view that actually players need to take criticism sometimes ahead of anyone else.
Yeah, you know, the only thing is, like, this is now, and we're gonna do a piece on this. I'm gonna do a piece on this today. Basically, what sums up a lot of this is the centre halves. Wenger has signed so many, and they've all eventually had the same problem. And if it's this common with so many players and it's going through so many... this has been going on for a decade now, really, this Arsenal situation. And it's got progressively worse, given 2008 they were actually quite good. But there were still some of the fundamental familiar issues there. If it's this familiar, then the problem isn't all these different players.
The stereotypical softness of an Arsenal central defender was completely shown in a nutshell by that Mustafi mistake.
Yeah.
For the goal, which they replayed a lot post-match and analysed. And I think it was Jamie Redknapp who was having a go at him because they were coming out from a corner and he didn't run back from the corner. And basically, he never got goal side. He never, at no point was he goal side of Aguero, and eventually kind of just stood in front of him. And Aguero didn't do anything. Like,
yeah,
you know, I can believe you'd appeal for it because you're embarrassed, but he appeals for the foul. And then sprints towards the ref when Aguero scores faster than he ran back from the corner, which is, it looks terrible. Obviously, the optics on it are awful. But it is a problem that you've identified, that the centre-backs that Arsene Wenger buys do not get better. In fact, they get worse.
Well, why do you think that is?
Well, people close to the club say just lack of coaching.
Yeah.
There's just not enough. And it is amazing with Steve Bould there, given what a defender he was. And kind of what an organisational figure. But again, I suppose you do get the sense that anything he can do is still kind of overshadowed by just the general structure and what Wenger is
trying
to do.
Yeah, he can't, like, he cannot install a coaching ethos where one doesn't exist, when he's not the main man.
And you can only do so much. I remember Ian Wright telling me once, basically, that one of the things that always stood out for him with the defence he played with, which was the archetypal Arsenal defence, was that, say it was 1-0 in the game, or he said it was particularly the case in title run-ins, and when you get to that situation of the season where you just have to do your job, just get the win and keep going. Tony Adams used to be brilliant for saying, right, at a certain point of the game, everyone just dropped 10 yards. And like, there was just that inherent structure there and players that knew what to do. Yeah. Whereas this is a defence that doesn't know how to do that.
No, there's no idea. I remember Tony Adams famously once said about Arsene Wenger that he couldn't coach his way out of a paper bag.
And yeah, it seemed ludicrous at the time, but...
And for all his post-career criticisms and curiosity, Sol Campbell you know, was supposed to be one of the best leaders as a centre back, because, you know, what did he say the other day? I'm one of the most intelligent minds in the game, or something. He did have the intelligence to read games and basically boss around the people in front of him. And the thing is, you know, look at players. Players do listen. If you're a senior figure in the side, they're going to listen to you. And maybe it's a case of those successful Arsenal teams, the defenders ran themselves. You know, it wouldn't be the first time we've seen that sort of thing in a football team, and they did it to great success. But
well, it was a George Graham as well, to be fair. That kind of put that structure on them as well.
Right, but by the time it was Invincibles, I mean, you can't put that on being pre-Wenger, because Wenger had been there for 7 or 8 years by that point.
Yeah.
But you can say that in the last 10 years, not a single defender's arrived at the club.
Once everyone from that 90s era Arsenal defence had gone, they started to have these defensive problems, which I think says a lot.
Yeah, and it, you know, it obviously doesn't work now. It is almost like I'd expected when Wenger leaves Arsenal to them to have this sort of dip, this post-Wenger dip. Mm. And, you know, I think they're almost having it now. I actually think when someone comes in, it's going to be a kind of a fresh boost for the club.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, I think so.
It's gone so far.
I think that's a really good point, because it won't be like Ferguson, where there's this kind of like collapse, basically, or this kind of vortex. I think in reality, they will, you know, people. A good new manager who can give them a bit of spark, a bit of direction, organisation, should actually improve them in a way which is the opposite of what happened when Sir Alex left United.
And they're pre-filling the power vacuum that would be in terms of decision making within the club on the key elements of, you know, the guys they've brought in recently. It does suggest. Do you think, if I was going to say, does he go this summer? Does he go the summer after? What are you going for?
Well, there is a theory going around that he's going to bring it forward and go this summer. Yeah. Well, this hasn't been confirmed by anyone.
There will always be these theories. Just
the caveat to what we're saying here as well is that it's been the same story now for the last 3 years. I mean, and I think that's probably more accurately reflective of the situation, that it is right now, just as it has been for the case for the past 3 seasons, it is a bit 50-50 that, you know, depending on how things go, depending on his mood, he could decide. I would imagine... Yeah. Just like last season, even he himself doesn't really know at the moment.
Yeah, well, for the listeners, the theory going around is that although Wenger signed a two-year deal last year, Arsenal wants to avoid a situation like last season where they had a season that was dominated by will you sign, will you quit. And therefore, if Wenger were to step aside this summer, at the end of this season, they would avoid having a season dominated by speculation and could therefore get the new guy in. Whether or not that will happen, I don't know. I mean, it hasn't been...
When it's the big one, when it's a decision of that magnitude, like, and the only one like it is Sir Alex Ferguson retiring. Sir Alex Ferguson revealed later that decision was taken in December with his wife, Kathy. And the real story that tipped that one over the edge into people knew it was happening was... Dave McDonald at the Mirror did a story about Fergie's hip-hop, meaning he was going to miss the start of the season. And that's when it began to unravel. But that wasn't until, I think, March or April.
Yeah, it was March,
March or April that year. So the thing with Wenger going is, if that decision has been taken, which would make a load of sense, I completely agree, actually, with the reasoning, is last year it was so toxic, because everyone knows the contract hasn't been signed, because you'd announce the new contract, you know, and if you're a PLC or whatever, you have to announce the new contract. I know they're not, but it's one of those things where we know it's got 3 months remaining and the results are bad. Can we keep him? Like, it's difficult to announce a new contract when you're 4 games without a win, you're 6th place in the Premier League, whatever, as they were last year. I appreciate you want to avoid that. So if that decision's been taken at the highest level last summer, there's probably only a gaggle of people like 3 or 4 strong that know about this.
Yeah.
But any time from now is when you'd expect the things to start falling into place.
Although, to be fair, it was up until May last season that they still didn't know whether he was actually going to sign.
And in 2014 as well.
And it is people like, you know, people that helped make the decisions.
Yeah, no, really.
But the one thing it indicates about the League Cup final as well is it shows maybe how ludicrous is almost a word the situation it is at Arsenal, that winning the League Cup in terms of the mood towards him staying wouldn't have made any difference, just as winning the FA Cup in 3 of the 4 last seasons didn't make too much of a difference in the mood either. I mean, it still doesn't escape all the issues.
Completely. And also, like, you know, I don't see how... I know last year they came sixth, but because they won the cup, they could just about sell the new contract to the fans. But this year, they're obviously, you know, they're now not going to finish the season with the trophy unless they win the Europa League. And what, if they come sixth again? Like, how can they...
Is there any way they're not going to finish
sixth? How can you justify keeping... having an Arsenal team finish sixth 2 years in a row?
Like, well, it was fifth last year, actually, remember?
Sorry, fifth last year. In a season when they've just, like, yes, they've lost Sanchez, but they've also tied Ozil to, what, £350,000 a week deal?
That Ozil deal, we said at the time, is always going to be judged, actually, probably not on what he does at all, but on the direction the club goes in the next two or three seasons. Mm. And if Wenger did stay for another 2 years, in which they finished sixth both years and lost a couple of finals, whatever, then that is going to be seen as the rewarding of mediocrity and lazy players, right? Whereas, you know, if someone else comes in and they return to the elite, whatever, then it's going to be seen as like a sign of strength and the fact they've held down one of their best players. Days like yesterday when, you know, Gary Neville was laying into the players that weren't running about and he obviously was implying, you know, the usual suspects. It just feels like, you know, it becomes a stick to beat the club with, even though I think universally everyone agrees that the Ozil new deal was important for them because it is a player that they need. There's also, you know, he's talking about running and stuff. It, fundamentally, there was a thing at Sloan Sports Conference this week that showed that Lionel Messi runs kind of one of the least in the Barcelona team, but that his ability to draw players, you know, an economy of movement. And if you look at, there was a metric they were showing where the top five players in terms of least movement but economy of movement were all kind of elite players, showing, I guess, that it isn't necessarily all about the running. Anything else you want to add on this game before we move on? Man City? I mean, what else is there to be said about Manchester City this season?
Well, I mean, touched earlier on the Fernandinho injury, which I think will probably be an issue in the next few games, although maybe not for the Champions League. I thought Vincent Kompany was very impressive. A performance that I didn't think he still had in him.
Yeah.
Given he's only that was only his 13th start of the season, I think. But he was really good. And even though he's probably not going to be around much next season, you think, with Otamendi, Laporte and Stones.
How old is Vincent Kompany now?
31. Turned 32 in April.
So you couldn't see him retiring at the end of the season, I think.
I don't know. I wouldn't be massively... It wouldn't be the biggest shock.
Yeah, of course.
I can't see him going anywhere else. I'm sure that City want to employ him in some...
I think City Football Group surely want to keep him,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm sure he'll still be an employee of City.
Whether he wants to go into politics, doesn't he?
Whether he'll keep playing next year, I don't know.
He is way too intelligent a man, I think, and City know him, and they know he cares about the club and whatever. He's been there 10 years now, that's right?
Yeah, he joined in 2008.
Yeah, when he joined, I was working at the hotel where he was living, and he, every day, always took time to... like just chat to random people, whatever. He actually helped me practice my French, which was quite nice. But he's like a good, intelligent man in the mold of, like, you know, the way that Guardiola and co kept Patrick Vieira on.
Yeah. Mm.
I think Vincent Kompany, if he decides that he can't do Premier League anymore, if he went and played in the MLS or whatever for a couple of seasons, I don't know, but I wouldn't let him go. Because he has sporting director or whatever.
Yeah, well, he's
all
been
over
doing
him.
A degree as well in his spare time.
What's he been doing?
I think it's in business.
Okay.
So I mean, he could very plausibly go on to, yeah, to work on that kind of front office side.
He feels like a man who's extremely capable, I think, outside the pitch. And it would be nice, I guess. It would be a very fitting thing for City if they won their first ever Champions League and he was the guy to lift that trophy.
Yeah, yeah, and I think all clubs want to have former players in these big executive roles, right? Like, it's like the kind of, whether it's Bayern Munich or Barcelona, it's such a, it's very important to the brand.
It's a good look.
And to brand
that brings me on to something I forgot to talk about. Apart from the Gary Neville rant was, again, you guys didn't see it because you were at the game. I don't think I may be being unfair to Jamie Redknapp here, who I like a lot. It felt very much as if he was put up to suggesting Thierry Henry, his Sky Sports colleague, as a replacement for Arsene Wenger. To which Thierry Henry responded, you know, like, of course I would like to take over. It would be a dream, etc., etc. Then Sky Sports put that on their website, that story on their website with Thierry Henry saying, yeah, I'd like to take over from Wenger and stuff. So it doesn't seem like an accident. I feel like if he wanted that story killed,
yeah,
but, you know, Thierry could have killed that.
or act a bit more embarrassed, maybe. Kind of,
So he has had, you know, him and Wenger, I think Wenger's called him out a couple of times in press conferences. Henri was the under-18s coach, was it?
Yeah.
For a little while, and then he turned his back on that to do something else.
I've also heard Wenger in general has felt a bit under siege from the media, and he has felt in the last few months that former Arsenal players like Henri could have been a bit more kind of, you know.
And by the way, if I was Wenger, I would feel exactly the same.
He's made some very, very pointed comments in press conferences about how, like, why should these guys who left Arsenal for money be seen as the true voice of Arsenal and not, you know, the guys who are still here.
Yeah.
But it was interesting having Henri in there, I think, in the what do you call it, the studio, I guess, because he has been a player under Wenger and under Guardiola, and he did gush about Guardiola and his coaching methods and did not come close to talking in the same way about Wenger. So it's obviously who he feels is the greater coach here.
I think the problem with Guardiola is that his kind of unique career has encouraged a generation of ex-players that they need only the slightest bit of experience, and then they can walk into to the biggest managerial jobs in the world and probably win the Champions League at the first attempt.
Forgive me for getting parochial for a second. On that, I remember around 2005-06 when there was this trend of people like Marco van Basten getting the Dutch job. And so in the Irish situation, if we just give it to a former player, you know, there's a trend here, there's a pattern. So they gave it to Steve Staunton, which was a disaster.
But Zidane's done it, though. You know, Zidane was the Real Madrid Guardiola almost.
Again, he has done it in a unique circumstance.
Of course, very unique.
Some of the best players in the world. Whereas I think since Pep, you know, whether it's Alan Shearer or Tim Sherwood, or actually, frankly, Tim Sherwood had more experience taking that Tottenham job than Pep did at Barcelona, or any number of AC Milan managers. Like, it seems to be such a kind of glib solution.
Yeah.
I remember years ago, even in...
it's not best practice, really, is it?
Like, no, it certainly isn't.
I think it was when Palace hired Pulis that they had Alan Shearer apply. And, you know, all he had on his CV was that 3-4 month spell at Newcastle. Although, did read in Kieran Dyer's book, he said he was very complimentary about Alan Shearer's managerial ability and felt that he was a guy kind of lost to the game because of...
That bad spell.
He's improved. Mm-hmm. He's obviously had a bit of coaching or something. I think he's got a lot better than when he first kind of came on screen. But I think there is this trend because Clarence Seedorf applied for the Oxford United job a couple of weeks ago and then ended up as, he's now Deportivo La Coruña manager, having failed in about 3 jobs. You do get the premium of, if you were a good player, you do get trusted with jobs. Mm. And we're about to see it with Arsenal AC Milan in the Europa League. Gennaro Gattuso's managerial career is essentially a one-man wrecking ball of every club he's been at.
Can you name them?
Pisa, Palermo, Salzburg.
I'm going to say FC Sion.
FC Sion in Switzerland. I think that's right. And probably one more. I don't know, someone.
It's Perugia as well.
Possibly. But he's basically not done very well. And then he was at Milan Primavera, which is just the Milan under-23s team. And then got bumped up.
Managing on pure emotion.
I imagine he's a great motivator. I'll give him that. I just don't know if he's going to have the tactical acumen.
Like an Italian Owen Coyle.
Yes, but like... I imagine
he's Roy Keane.
He's more Roy Keane. Yeah. I mean, he is the Italian Roy Keane, right? But that's kind of how I would expect
Keane was a better player for me.
Well, yeah, obviously Keane's a better player. I mean, I like Roy Keane. I think he... But I don't know what he brought to them. I'd be interested to hear what he brought into the managerial team talks in terms of tactics and stuff. I wonder how much he thought about that sort of stuff. He probably has a very similar view to Gary Neville in terms of you do your job,
This is quite an interesting topic on that. And in terms of this whole idea of players who were formerly brilliant players who had a great career and the kind of implicit knowledge that they can transmit what they know. I remember being at a Roy Keane press conference, and I think Ken Early has brought this up before as well, in which he was asked about kind of, you know, how he can take Darren Gibson onto the next level. This is when as Ireland's assistant manager now. And it was like, he was so enthusiastic about it, but couldn't quite articulate what he wanted to say. And it kind of, you know, he was talking about how Gibson needs to, you know, impose himself more in games. And he goes, well, how do you coach him to do that? How do you do that? And he kind of, like, it was quite simplistic, his response. Kind of, you just got to, you know, make a tackle or... And, like, well, okay. So, and I suppose, ultimately there, it's trying to give a player the know-how that you have, and some are probably just adept at explaining it. And
I've seen Keane kind of talking about this similar thing before. I can't remember who has been scathing about, but basically what he was saying is, in a game, when you've got, you're up against a midfielder, such a midfielder who receives the ball from the centre backs and wants to turn and pass it, you know that what he wants to do is turn around, look up, and hit a pass. Mm. All you have to do is, if you nip at his ankles every time he gets the ball, even if you know you're going to get nowhere near the ball, if he feels you slam into the back of him every time he gets the ball back to goal, he will pass it backwards every single time. And that's kind of the thing I think he was getting at.
Yeah, of course.
And the game I was watching, he was frustrated because they were giving this player time to, you get the ball, you turn, you look up, and then you can play the pass. Mm-hmm. And I think things like that are more like, it's a psychological dissuasion more than anything, because the player could have turned him. But it's more of it's a psychological thing where you're making people know who is where.
But there's an interesting thing here as well, and that this is, I suppose, the difference between great coaches and great players, and one reason maybe why players who had to make themselves better in a position, like Guardiola, who had to kind of think about the game and ultimately and rationalize everything, are better coaches. Because if you know on an instinctive level, sometimes you just do things without having a full comprehension of what...
Strikers, a lot of the time. That's why, there's a theory that players like Alan Shearer or like Harry Kane, maybe. Harry Kane might not make a great manager because a lot of his stuff is done on instinct or whatever. Or like Filippo Inzaghi, who has become a manager but has had mixed results. Because if you're a guy who thrives on instinct and whatever, you might not necessarily think about what you're doing, whereas centre-backs who always have the game ahead of them, or defensive midfielders who are looking and analysing the field.
Which is specifically Guardiola's role.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting debate.
What about Busquets? I mean, he could be an interesting coach. It's one of the guys, certainly, coaching.
Xabi Alonso is one of the current players who you'd think would probably be the best manager.
And he wants to go into coaching.
Mikel Arteta, obviously like a kind of less good Alonso as a player, but he's someone who has walked from, after retiring from Arsenal, had both Pochettino and Guardiola, two of the best managers in the Prem, fighting to get him onto their coaching staff. Guardiola won it, and he's now kind of in Guardiola's very inner circle, devising match scenarios with Guardiola. That is testament to the amount of thinking that Arteta has done about football and the sort of football brain that he has on him, which is inseparable from the type of player that he was.
Okay, and on that as well, going off mostly everything actually Xavi's ever said, but mostly his Diego Torres interview, Xavi Hernandez, I think from the sound of him, he could be a brilliant manager for an absolutely top-level team, but because he's so dogmatic, really struggle with anything below that, because if he can just register.
It's the Guardiola thing, right?
Yeah, maybe, but then Guardiola seems more adaptable.
No, I believe, obviously, Guardiola is an elite coach in terms of what he's done. Like, he has made the three clubs he's been at into some of the most attracting passing football teams I've ever seen. So I don't think you can doubt his quality as a coach. Like, anyone who does and puts it down to the players is absolutely insane. But I do think there is an element of that you probably need high-level technical players to execute what he wants to do. Yeah, if you put him in a seventh-place team, if you put him in Everton, what would Guardiola's Everton look like? Now, they probably play really nice football, but they're not going to have the level to execute how he wants.
Roberto Martinez is Everton.
Precisely. Yeah, Wigan. You know? Like, that's the
Yeah, that I think is the most interesting unanswered question about Guardiola.
Yeah.
It's also a question that we'll never really get an answer to, because why would he go?
Yeah. Why would you drop down a level?
Why would you go and coach a mid-table team
unless he decides
not win anything?
Unless it's like some hometown team that he really fancies. But I think he's a
Barcelona. He wants to go to Brescia at some point, doesn't he? Isn't that?
Yeah. Brescia would be cool. I mean, it would be an interesting football experiment.
Yeah.
That if you're so rich and so successful, you could go and do it. Only Guardiola probably will be in the position. It'd be like Mourinho going to União Leiria or something like that to see if he can take them rising up the Portuguese.
Although I do think Mourinho would be better at coaching bad players than Pep would, because it's more about...
He'd win League Two in no time.
It's a classic thing of basically, I suppose a lot of football's Mourinho, has in that kind of famous kind of discussions by Igor Saki, it's football of the week. That it's football designed to minimize the effect of superior players and minimize risk essentially. That's exactly it, because if there's more risk in the game, it's more open, it's going to favor those.
Tony Pulis says it, you know, if you make a mistake with the ball, more often you concede than if you make a mistake without the ball.
Yeah,
so make sure you don't have the ball.
And the classic point I'm actually getting, I suppose, if you're not as good as the opposition, you don't go toe-to-toe with them. You just frustrate them.
On which point, we've gone completely off Arsenal-Man City, though it was, as we said, an interesting final for a number of reasons. There were, unbelievably, other games this weekend. Tottenham beat Palace 1-0, so they continue to be in there. Harry Kane, once again, coming up with a goal in the big moment, but it could have been 6 or 7. The biggest, most impactful result from Saturday, which was a pretty dull slate of games, Liverpool smashed West Ham and looked pretty good. You know, they really. And David Moyes said that attacking-wise, that's the most problems almost that any team's ever given him. But the big deal, I guess, is West Brom losing at home to Huddersfield, losing 2-1. Alan Pardew isn't going to go. They're giving him the Watford game. It sounds like the lack of credible alternatives is proving a huge problem, which is something we saw with Stoke and Mark Hughes. Does that beg the question, what do these clubs see as a credible alternative? Because given they've got no new manager bounce with Pardew, what could be worse?
I was actually just thinking that. I mean,
you know, wouldn't you, if you're West Brom now, would you have pulled the trigger after this Huddersfield defeat at home?
Yeah. At this point, given the cost of going out for the Premier League and how certain it looks likely they'll go down at the moment, given the current situation, now is actually when it's completely justifiable to do a kind of take a bit of a punt.
Yeah, genuinely. Like anyone.
Yeah, they are in a Hail Mary situation.
Look, I'd just go to Ireland and be like, can we have Roy Keane for 3 months? Because if Roy Keane motivates your boys... Yeah. The problem is
Tim Sherwood, Joe Kinnear.
Yeah, because it does feel as if like with Stoke, they waited and waited because they want the perfect kind of medium term appointment. Mm. But if they don't get that now, they're going to completely do their short term.
And they're now in the bottom two, Stoke and West Brom. West Brom are 7 points adrift with 10 to go. Now at the top of the table, it's harder to make up points than it is at the bottom of the table, obviously. But you don't get 20 points from 28 games and then make up that sort of gap. So it does feel as if West Brom are toast. They have all agreed, the UK side and the China side of the club have agreed to give Pardew the Watford game. And they have to think about the long-term consideration, I guess. If they do get relegated, you might want to keep Pardew because he would be a very good manager for the Championship, potentially, I guess. But you've got to look at it. This is a club that are going to get relegated probably 95% likely, I'd feel. You have to roll the dice, don't you, on the 5%?
Yeah. Actually, on that, completely, I agree. And they are, it's particularly bad for them to be in this situation because it's not too long ago since they were seen as kind of this really good model again, similar to Swansea and Southampton.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they must be in the top half of the table in terms of how long they've been in the Premier League.
Well, I think they've been out of it for about 3 of the last 15 years.
Since they were last out?
Yeah. There's been a lot of turnover. I mean, and this changes on a weekly basis because it's so tight, the relegation picture. Swansea, who were completely revived under Carlos, are now back down to 18th. So they're below the line again.
Yeah.
They're level on points with Palace and Southampton, who are 2 points behind Newcastle, who threw away what would have been a massive win against Bournemouth. Huddersfield on 30, West Ham on 30. Brighton on 31 look safe almost now. The way they've turned it around... We said in January they needed goals. They brought in Jurgen Lacadia for a club record fee from PSV. He got his first goal. Glenn Murray got a double. Knockert, who's been troublesome. When you see him play, he does play well. But he's actually started scoring goals again, which is crucial.
Here we go. West Brom have been in the Premier League longer than 11 clubs and currently in it. And since 6 of those, actually 7 of those, given Everton as well.
So what, the top, Man City United, Liverpool, Tottenham, Chelsea, Arsenal,
Everton,
Leicester.
Not Leicester.
Arsenal, Everton.
And Stoke.
So actually,
Stoke and West Brom, two of the longest-serving clubs could end this season.
And, you know, you can't even say Stoke are going to go down because they're only 1 point behind three teams on 27. Talking about the relegation picture, as I said, is impossible because it's such a mess. But the West Brom situation is curious because, again, it's a club that's been taken over because of their Premier League status, because of the wealth that the TV rights deals bring in. And I think we're going to see a plateauing as well of those TV rights deals. So some of these clubs that brought in thinking it's going to be an endless cash cow, we've seen what happens when foreign owners pull out, and a lot of the times it's very unpleasant for clubs.
Can I go?
Yes. Yes. Okay. So, in fact, we'll all go. That's Jack Pitbrook dashing out of the studio.
Are we going to leave that in? I think.
Yeah, leave it in. Why not?
Nice bit of colour.
And so that's the life of a busy sports journalist, Jack Pitbrook, off to meet an important contact. From him at Wembley yesterday, may I say thanks. Miguel, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And a reminder that Manchester United versus Sevilla is next week, or maybe the week after.
No, it's the week after.
It's the week after. We've got a little bit of time running left on that competition. So if you go to our reviews on iTunes, if you subscribe to the podcast and leave a rating and review, you will automatically go into the draw to win a Sevilla shirt from our friends at New Balance. And you know, it's a prize for listening. And if you don't like the podcast, then remember, you can always get a refund. Until that point, I've been Ed Mallion. This has been the Indie Football Podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.